But yeah. I hope you get that, your tattoo you were talking about. That would be really cool.
Yeah.
To show pictures when you, when it's all healed up and not gross anymore.
Yeah.
Well, when it's immediately done, and then when it's all healed up and not gross anymore.
Yeah. The two varying states of a tattoo.
Yeah. Oh, have you seen the, like, the new, like, second skin stuff they do now?
Yeah.
Where they
use that on me.
On your
when
ankle?
I got my ankle, yeah.
Oh, right. Man, it looks so weird on big tattoos, though. I'm like, mm-hmm. I don't know if I could, like, sit with just, like, this on me.
I actually got for... a roll of it so that I can use it, you know, as needed, so.
Yeah. I mean, it's super cool, and it makes so much sense to have it done that way, but mm-hmm. it's just like, man, does not look like fun to just exist with, and then doesn't necessarily look like fun to, like, look at.
I got it on, I put it on my ankle when I, because I had to go back to work the next day and I had to wear boots.
Yeah.
And so I said, what should I do for this? Like, do you want thick socks? Like, how do you want me to do it? And she goes, just some second skin should be good. And like told me where to get it. And so I was unwrapping it and putting it in new skin as needed. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I've seen where they started using, what is it? It's like tilapia skin, I think, on like burn victims and mm-hmm. stuff.
That was a while ago. I saw fish skin in like South America.
It's super cool. It looks fucking crazy, though. Mm-hmm. It looks like someone has scales like growing out of their body versus like you understand that it's healing. You can even see it healing.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it looks like a mutant has just like washed up on shore or something. Mermaids are real.
So are the X-Men.
All right.
Yep.
Sorry, I got a text message. I was like, well, I better check, make sure it's not Elise. It was Elise.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I still, if you would have talked to me when I was like 18, I would have told you I'm going to be covered in tattoos. I still don't have any.
I just have two, but in this economy.
Right? Well, I wanted to be a tattoo artist. Like, I was like all in.
Yeah.
And then just because it was so difficult to get started where I lived and I didn't feasibly have a way to not be, you know, where I lived because I was still living with my parents and everything. And then it just never happened. I really wanted, I really thought that was going to be what I was going to do though.
Nothing's stopping you.
That's true.
Get an apprentice job on the weekends.
What time?
Oh yeah, that's right. You would have to prioritize it.
Yeah.
You would have to say, okay, well, I want to do this. I have to figure out if I want to keep streaming or whatever else I do on the week. I have to figure out if I want to keep doing a podcast.
Yeah. I don't know. The places that we have that are, like, close to me are not known for being necessarily the best either.
Yeah, but you have Tulsa right there.
Yeah, that's true.
And plus, you also don't need to. My one coworker has a tattoo gun. And
oh,
she
yeah,
and her husband just tattoo each other at home.
Yeah. I had a friend in just after high school who just bought a tattoo gun and taught herself how to do it on herself and just would do it.
Couldn't be me.
And she was pretty good at it too, especially for being self-taught. I don't think she does it anymore though. But she was a really good artist and it just translated well. Like a portrait artist.
Yeah, I think you would have to figure out what you would want to tattoo also, because your art is a lot of like character work.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the going like desire in the world is for character art tattoos.
Pretty high.
Because I have one of the people that I see, she's actually the one who did the flash art on my ankle. Like a lot of her stuff is like women witchy characters.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want just a random person on me. That's just not what I would like for myself.
Yeah.
So I don't know how, she has a lot that I see not getting done, which is why I was asking. I don't know what the go is for that.
Yeah. I mean, characters and, you know, different characters from, like, shows and games and stuff like that's always decently popular.
There's one in Richmond that does a lot of, like, anime stuff.
Yeah. But anyway, that's probably enough about tattoos.
Now we're a tattoo podcast.
Welcome to The Strange and Unusual, where we discuss the strange and unusual. This is episode 179 of our series, seeking out the weird, the unexplained, and the devious from around the world. I'm Roya.
And I'm Casey.
And this week, we will be talking about a fellow who is maybe a good reason to not rush into a relationship. Henri Landru. So, you can find us on social media. We're on all of them, pretty much. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, threads, and Patreon at patreon.com/strangeandusual. All of those will be at the end of the end of the show in more detail, as well as in the show notes. So you can come and check us out and interact with us over there. We'd really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Sure would.
Okay. So wee-woos. Murder? You decide. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Fake attempts at bigamy. France. Me trying to pronounce French names. And suicide. I don't remember where suicide comes in, but it's in here somewhere. Is it oh, no, I do. I remember now. Yep.
Okay, well.
It's not a big... It's just kind of a passing sad thing. Like so many situations. Yeah. So recently we did a poll on our Patreon for our members, and while Bluebeards did not win, there was some interest in them. So I wanted to cover a case of what I would have done for that episode, basically. So some people might wonder what a Bluebeard even is. And I'll tell you. Basically the male version of a Black Widow. A man who kills wives in order to gain property or money from her death. So it's derived from an old folktale in Europe, and has even been adapted by the Grimm brothers into one of their stories, which is where I actually heard it, called The Robber Bridegroom. So the TLDR of it is that a man marries a few women, normally like 5 or 6, over a short time. And the wife is either explained as running away or passing away, so he seeks out another bride. He gets the daughter of a family and charms her into marrying him. When he marries her, he takes her home and things are great. He's a gentle, doting husband, everything that she's ever wanted. But he has to live on a he has to leave on a business trip not long after getting married. In some versions of the story, he entrusts his wife with a key that unlocks the doors, all the doors in the house, but forbids her from going into one specific room. I think in the Grimm version, he gives her an egg and says that she has to keep that on her at all times. And
freaky.
Yeah, and things are going fine, but then curiosity gets the best of her, as would anyone, I think, and she opens the door. And inside the room, there are all of his former wives. In Grimm's version, they're her sisters.
Oh.
And they're all either cut into pieces in a basin in the middle, or they're, like, hung up on hooks. Either way, they're all super dead. And in her panic, she drops the key slash egg into the basin of blood, and when she gets it out, it returns stained, and she's unable to clean it, thus confirming that she had been in the room she was not supposed to go into. So when he returns home, she's made to show him her guilt, and he drags her back to the room to kill her as well. However, suspicions have reached her family, and her brothers come to call upon their sister's home and find her husband about to kill her. They chase the man down and kill him. Then, through the magic of fairy tales, she's able to return life back to the sisters in some versions, or in others, she's able to give the wives a proper burial. And as she was the legal wife, and he had no heirs, she inherited the estate and the fortune of her husband, which she uses to get her sisters married well and take care of her brothers that rescued her, and eventually was remarried herself. So that's where the actual Bluebeard moniker comes from, is that story. And it's just
there's, there's a game, there's a TTRPG by Magpie called Bluebeard's Bride.
Huh.
And it's basically this.
Yeah, and so there's a ton of different iterations. Sometimes he's portrayed as, like, being, like, West Asian. Sometimes it's, you know, he's from America. Sometimes it's, you know, like I said, sometimes it's an egg. Sometimes it's a key. Sometimes they're sisters. Sometimes they're not. It's all just sort of different things that have sort of turned into a cautionary tale of, you know, don't trust everyone who comes to you and offers you everything, because there's probably a catch. In this case, you get murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about a Bluebeard that lived in the 1880s to the 1920s in Paris, France, and the surrounding area. Henri Landru was born in Paris to Catholic parents, a father who was a furnace stoker, and a mother who was a laundress. He had an older sister, and he was an altar boy, and then later a subdeacon, which is basically just like a prep chef, but for the church. Like lighting candles, getting the priest ready, making sure everything was ready for the parishioners to come in, that kind of stuff. church is where he met his future wife, Mary Catherine, in 1887. So he and Marie Catherine would have an illegitimate daughter, also named Marie, which would not be confusing at all.
Ooh,
and
shit.
In 1891, that's when Marie was born in 1891. And then Henri would be pulled for his obligatory military service for 3 years.
Mm.
So in 1893, he returned to Paris, where he reunited with Marie Catherine, who was pregnant already with their second child, Maurice, and he married her at that
point. Yeah, I'd hope so. My God. Yeah.
The couple would have two more children, Suzanne in 1896 and Charles in 1900. And during the 1890s, Marie Catherine worked as a laundress, and Landru drifted from job to job. He was like a plumber's accountant, a furniture salesman, a toy maker. He just did a bunch of odd jobs, and he didn't really stay anywhere very long. But
as you said Marie Catherine that last time, I thought you were gonna say Marie Callender's. I was like, the Popeye lady.
Marie Catherine would describe him, though, as a model husband and a wonderful father. She had absolutely no complaint, absolutely, regardless of not being able to keep a consistent job
or marrying her on in a proper, timely manner.
Yeah, two kids in.
I guess we can get married now.
Yeah, there's a lot of illegitimate children and mothers in the story.
Oh, great.
In 1898, Landru started to become a bit unbalanced and started to drift into crime, seeming to be centered around his ambition to become a famous inventor. So in that year... Sorry?
Fancy.
Yeah. So in
crazy
that...
Crazy old Maurice.
So in that year, he designed a primitive motorbike and got money from potential investors to build a factory to manufacture it, but then he pocketed the money and vanished.
Ooh, pulled the producers on him.
Yeah.
Bialystok and Bloom style.
He also planned a suburban railway line west of Paris and an automated children's toy, all while being on the lam from the police and seeing very little of his family as a result.
Hmm.
In 1904, he was finally arrested in Paris after he slipped and fell while running away from a bank he was trying to defraud. And, like, that's how he got caught. Was just, like, banana peel cartoon incident. he even tried to defraud the prison by pretending to commit suicide.
Love that.
He waited until the guard was entering his cell and put his head through the noose. Like, as soon as he saw the guard. Like, he and the guard make eye contact. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna kill myself.
Oops, you totally got me trying to kill myself.
And he was subsequently examined by Dr. Charles Vallien, a leading criminal psychiatrist in France, who concluded that Landru was, quote, on the frontiers of madness, end quote, which is an excellent album name.
That's just how I'm going to refer to myself from now on. How are you? I'm on the frontiers of madness, man.
But he was not yet insane, and he could still carry responsibility for his action.
Sucks to suck, bro.
Yeah. Dr. Vallien was concerned, though, where this might lead in the future, and warned Marie Catherine to be on guard. Landru was sentenced to 2 years in jail and would spend the next decade in and out of prison. His wife and children lived in a series of cheap apartments around Paris in this time, unable to rely on her husband for anything at this point. And in 1909, he attempted to swindle a widow by posing as a wealthy single businessman and persuaded her to hand over her savings in a premarital contract. He was arrested when he was trying to cash in her investment certificates and sentenced to 3 years in prison. While he was incarcerated, his father actually committed suicide in April of 1912 by hanging.
Wow.
Yeah. Marie Catherine said that the suicide was partially because he was widowed, but also because of the shame he carried from Landru's criminal career.
Wow, that takes I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed to a whole new level.
I brought you into this world, don't worry, I'll take myself out.
Yeah. Damn.
In April of 1912, when he was released, Landru stole around 12,000 francs around 60,000 today. I think there was lots of shady money conversion websites I had to go through to figure this out, because like the franc has changed like 4 times in what mm-hmm. it's worth, like in the last 100-200 years. And so I had to find like that time frame and then translate it to the time frame that the conversion for that would let me in USD, which was like ended in 2015. So then I had to take that to one that would let me take it to 2024. And so 60,000 USD, I think, which is still like a fair amount That's of plenty. Money,
yeah.
especially for a single, basically a single mother of 4.
Mm-hmm.
But don't worry, because Landrew just stole it from her.
Of course.
And it was specifically left to Marie Catherine and for her children by Landrew's father. So he left it specifically to her, not to his own son, because he knew that his son was just going to fuck it up, like he had fucked up everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So in the winter of 1913 to 1914, he did his best con. He got over 35,000 francs from investors to build an automobile factory. Then he ran away with something close to 190,000-ish in today money, USD.
Not bad.
Yeah. So he went on the run in April 1914. Hopefully he avoids banana peels and doesn't yeah. slip and fall and get caught again. But he went on the run in April 1914 and was tried in July 1914 in absentia for the fraud, where he was convicted even though he wasn't there. So the court sentenced him to 4 years hard labor and exile for life on New Caledonia. Yeah, whenever they caught him.
I feel like some Jean Valjean shit.
So while he was on the run, he went to a village near Chantilly and met Jeanne Couchet, a 39-year-old widowed seamstress who knew him as Raymond Dyard.
What a cool alias.
I left out a lot of his aliases because he's got like one for every victim and there's like 12 victims. Like, so I left a lot of them out because it got really just like, and she knew him as this different, completely different name. And she knew him mm-hmm. as this completely different name. Like, none of these matter. So their relationship would change in August 1914, though, when Germany declared war on France.
What? I had no idea that that had happened.
So when Landrew failed to meet Couchet, who had returned to live in Paris with her 17-year-old son, she went to the house near Chantilly with her son André and her brother-in-law, hoping to find who she knew as Dyard. Instead, she found the house that she had known him to live in empty, and she found a chest with Landrew's true identity along with other fake documents. So when she arrived at Landrew's apartment in southern Paris, she found it also abandoned, and that was when she discovered his criminal status. Mm. So basically, she went to the house where she knew that he had lived when they met. He wasn't there. It was abandoned. She went to the apartment that was listed on the paperwork that she found in the abandoned house, and that was also abandoned.
Sounds like an episode of Who the Fuck Did I Marry?
Yeah, really. So she was adamant that her relationship with Landrew was over, but when he showed back up later that month, she resumed the relationship. André, her son, was very patriotic and was waiting with bated breath for his chance to serve in the military to defend France against the Germans. I wrote to defend France against the French, which they're their own worst enemy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
In November 1914, Couchet pulled André out of his job and the family moved to a house with Landrew about 35 kilometers northwest of Paris. Mid-January, André's scheduled recruitment for the military had been pulled in to summer 1915 and he was thrilled. He sent letters excited about this new opportunity to defend his country, but those were the last letters that he or his mother were, that was the last time he or his mother were ever heard from again. Were those letters that he wow. sent out. Whatever happened between him and the other two people unlocked something dark and sinister in Henri Landrieu, because he just couldn't stop killing. He met Thérèse Labourdelaine, who was 46, in the summer of 1915 after he placed a Lonely Hearts advertisement in Le Journal in May, or possibly through an ad that she had placed. So she was born in Argentina and was divorced and estranged from her only son. She was divorced and also estranged.
And also estranged. Got it. That I took a second there.
Yeah. I realized as soon as I read it, I was like, uh-oh. It's considered that she was murdered by Landru shortly after their encounter in the summer. He also met Marie-Angélique Guillen, who is 52, a widowed retired housekeeper who had inherited a large sum of money from her last employer. She answered the same ad that Therese did in May 1915 and believed Landru's story, reaching out to him, and was never seen again.
Sounds pretty par for the course here.
Yeah, Berthe Hion, 55, had lived a hard life before answering a Lonely Hearts ad in Le Journal. She had lived as a cleaning woman and had lost her husband, her longtime lover, two legitimate children, and one illegitimate daughter in childbirth.
That's sad.
Yeah. Landru was posing as a businessman in search of a wife to join him in Tunisia. And she believed him. Basically, like, to be a diplomatic, like, you know, cook the meal and make nice with their wives kind of deal.
Yeah.
But she was never seen or heard from again after reaching out to him.
Okay. Then, again, these all have aliases, so it's not like anybody's putting these clues together.
Yeah. Then there's Anna Colum, 44, who was a widow who worked as a typist for an insurance company in Paris. She'd had a string of lovers since the death of her husband nearly a decade earlier, and it would seem that her motive...
String of lovers. Get it, girl.
And it would seem that her motive for answering that same Lonely Hearts ad in May 1915 was because she was in search of a stepfather to legitimize her daughter. Her daughter was reportedly in the care of nuns in Italy, but after her mother's disappearance, the little girl was just never tracked down to provide the news to, which, like, that's super awesome and definitely not traumatic later in life.
Yeah, for real.
Anna was last seen in December 1916. Andre Babelé was a nanny and possibly a casual sex worker, and she was described as a chatty, vivacious 19-year-old.
I love a vivacious lady. I love anybody who's described as vivacious.
Yeah. She was picked up by Landru one evening in April 1917 and stayed with him for the next 10 days in a rented room in Paris and then another fortnight in his rented house. While she was at the house, she was seen by a local game warden learning how to ride a bike, and that was the last time anyone saw her.
This is getting pretty sus there, Mr. Yeah. Landru.
Celestine Buisson, 47, which I think is just such a pretty name, Celestine. I think it's super pretty. She also
sounds German.
I mean, I could just be saying it super bad. Totally possible.
Okay.
Hold on, I'll send it to you.
I mean, it could be.
Yeah.
It's next to Germany. Celestine, yeah.
But she also answered the Lonely Hearts ad. She was a widow who worked as a housekeeper and was, basically she was just lonely. Her son was called into military service and she just wanted someone to, like, be at home with her.
She wanted a companion.
That's
totally normal.
Yeah, she was trusting and only semi-literate, and the two became engaged almost immediately, but put the marriage off for more than 2 years.
Wow.
She is considered to have been murdered in September 1917.
God, I hope we're getting to the end here.
A couple more.
Cool.
Louise Jean, 38, was a devout Catholic who worked at a dress shop and answered a Lonely Hearts ad after deciding to divorce her estranged husband. She initially refused to sleep with Landru, but broke her resistance.
Ah.
and he took her on a trip to Gambias. On a one-way
for that one.
Yeah, it's a city in France. But took her on a one-way train ticket there after celebrating mass with her in Paris. It's believed she was murdered in November of 1917. So we're looking
were going to lead up with she was on a one-way ticket to hell. Like, like, damn, Roya.
No, he bought, it comes up later, but he frequently bought one-way tickets to the town he was living in for these women, and that kind of gets used as evidence against him later, which was like, you know, you weren't married to them, you can't prove that they left, you didn't buy a return ticket to them, so what happened to, like...
You weren't planning on sending them back, so what did you do?
Yeah. Let's see. And this is, like, a lot of these are happening with, like, a couple of months. Sometimes, like, this was September and November. Like, sometimes it's just a month in between. So, Anna Marie Pascal, 37, was known as Madame Sombrero for her love of wide-brimmed hats.
I love that. Good for you, girl.
She was divorced and childless and was looking for a sugar daddy, basically.
Hell yeah. Get it. Get that bread.
In 1916, she spotted Landru's Lonely Hearts ad, sent him a message. And it's believed that she was murdered in April 1908.
Ugh. One of these ladies has to survive, right?
One does, but she doesn't really get talked about. There's a few that go to his house and then left.
They're like, this is fucking creepy, dude. Bye.
But we'll get to a baddie who sort of breaks everything wide open here in a little bit.
All right, great.
I think this is the last victim. Yeah. So we've got Marie-Therese Machadier, 37. She was a career sex worker and was often seen on the street outside of her apartment where she walked her dog. She actually initially met Landru in October of 1918, but circumstantial evidence suggested that she may have encountered him actually several years earlier, like she knew him for a really long time.
Oh.
And it's considered that she was murdered in January 1919. So, Landru was able to dodge the police for a few different reasons. One large part being World War One.
Yeah.
Because most of France's civilian police force were of military age and were called to the front line. For example, the town where he rented his home in December 1914 to August 1915 only had one constable for the entire town. Like, that was the police force. The other town where he rented from December 1915 until his arrest had one constable in his early 70s. So, like, we're not dealing with, like, LAPD here. We're not dealing with, like, hundreds. This is some
Barney Fife shit.
Yeah. Yeah, we're dealing with, like, the two police officers that stay at the jail. Like...
yep.
So then Landru's wife and children knew where he was the whole time. So that's part two. But they shielded him from the police. So Charles, his youngest son, who was between 14 and 15 at the time of the crimes, had even assisted his father in removing furniture and possessions from four of the five known victims' apartments.
Wow. That's a ballsy kid.
Yeah. His eldest son, Maurice, was mobilized to the military in 1915 and was arrested soon after for various frauds and thefts, including the receipt and sale of valuables from Landru that had belonged to his first known victim. So
this is not the father we want to take after.
Yeah, so his kids were laundering the possessions of his victim. And while Maurice was released from prison, he continued to assist his father in spinning lies to tell family and friends of the victim. Landru's wife was not innocent in her participation either, forging the signature of the eighth victim so that Landru could access her bank accounts, and impersonating the ninth victim for the same reason.
Marie Callender, I was rooting for you.
The third benefit that he had that helped him evade arrest was an overall indifference of the police officers and officials, because at the time, hundreds of thousands of young men were dying in war. They weren't paying attention to a few women in the grand scheme of things going missing. This was happening a lot.
Fuck them women.
So, in truth, Landru was primarily thwarted by a very persistent woman by the name Marie Lacoste. So, Marie was the younger half-sister of Celestine, and she was an unmarried housemaid who did not like Henri Landru.
That's right, girl.
He was going by George Fremiet at the time, when she was introduced to him. That was the alias. So over the next 2 years, Marie began to believe that her sibling's fiancé was a marriage swindler. She was just like, look, he's up to some shit. He was just out to get his hands on his sister's savings. And that was confirmed for Marie when her sister told her that she had allowed Landru to take charge of her investments.
No, Celestine.
Yeah.
Dumbass.
Yeah. However, Celestine refused to take Marie's advice and end her engagement. And that left the sisters barely on speaking terms. Because Marie's like, look, all of this evidence is pointing to him not being a good guy. And you're just saying, but I love him. And that doesn't make him not a bad guy, suddenly.
Look, look, I know a few things about talking to people about husbands that are not good guys. And they just go, yeah, but I love him. And I'm just like, you call me when you need the U-Haul and I will be there. But you can't make somebody listen to you. No. Unfortunately.
And that's kind of what happens here, unfortunately. So a day later, Landru took Celestine back to Gambias, where she was never seen again. And
I need to see how that place is spelled. Gambias just does not sound like a French name.
It doesn't. I'm bad at French.
Oh, you know what would help if I glasses. Put my fucking glasses on?
I can't see without my glasses.
Gambé would probably be how I would say it.
Gambé.
Or maybe Jambé.
Jambé, okay.
It's hard to know if it's a soft or a hard G.
I don't know, man. But, I'm a fan of Gambias.
Well, first of all, it would be Gambice.
Yeah, I know.
You dumbass.
Damn.
You were dyslexic about the I and the A.
Yeah.
On top of everything else.
Damn. Say it again for me. Jambé?
Gambé.
Okay. So a few days later, Landru took Celestine back to Jambé, and she was never seen again. So autumn 1917, Landru became increasingly alarmed that Marie may suspect him, and tried to reassure her by sending her 2 fake postcards signed by Celestine. Marie immediately recognized the signatures were forgeries.
Yeah.
And was thinking that Landru was a con man, but didn't actually suspect him of murdering her sister. Like, that's a big jump, you know? And so Landru wasn't put at ease, though, and he turned up alone several times at Marie's workplace to invite her to dinner with her sister.
Mm.
At the time, Celestine was dead, and her apartment had been emptied, and so this was almost certainly an attempt for him to murder her younger sister.
Yep.
However,
I'm gonna kill you back, bitch.
However, every time Marie refused him and eventually told Landru to just basically fuck off and not come back.
Get it, Marie.
Marie washed her hands of the situation, deciding that her half-sister must have just been too ashamed about falling for a crook to meet her face-to-face anymore. That she would be there if she ever wanted to, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be there with the U-Haul kind of vibes.
Yep. You call me when you are ready, bitch. That's my vibe.
Yeah, but in December 1918, she received a letter about Celestine's son. He'd been blinded in battle and had reached out to his mother to try to borrow money to, you know, survive.
Yeah.
But when he hadn't heard from her, he reached out to his aunt, which moved her into action. Because there was no way. Celestine, remember, she was the one who was, like, looking for a husband because she missed her son so much.
Right.
Like, she wasn't going to just ignore a letter from her only son that she loved dearly. This did not make sense. So she went to Celestine's old apartment, but the concierge told her that her half-sister hadn't been seen there since the summer of 1917. We're now in December 1918.
Yeah. Well, she's only been gone for a year. No worries.
Yeah. That information was enough for Marie to think that Landru had actually killed her half-sister and had intended on killing her when he invited her to the apartment, because Marie is one smart cookie.
Yeah.
She got immediately to work. She compiled a file for the police, including Landru's physical appearance, known movements since 1915, the location of the house near Gambé. I don't know why sometimes I made it with a B in the front, but that's definitely not what it was. I don't know why I typed that. Basically everything. His thefts about Celestine's bank accounts, the forged postcards, the phony invitation, all of it. Like, here, police, here is all of the evidence that you need to think that there is something.
I did your job for you.
Yeah, to think that there is something suspicious about this guy. So, on January 11th, 1919, she took the file to the local police station in Paris and was accompanied by a maid that she worked with named Laurie Bonnoir, who had met Landru, like, in passing before. So she knew what he looked like. She could help identify him. She could confirm some stuff. Basically another eyewitness.
Mm-hmm.
The cops told her that she'd have to take it to the police in Gombe. And she said, fuck that. And reached out to the mayor instead.
Damn.
In a letter, she wrote, quote, "You have in your commune a house at about 100 meters from the church, which is called the Maison the name of the owner, I do not know him, but the house was rented in 1917 to a gentleman around 40 years who had a long brown beard and who has as his name Monsieur Fremiet. Therefore, this gentleman lived in the house for a good part of the summer of 1917 with a woman about 45 to 50, more exactly 47, with blue eyes and chestnut hair with a medium height," end quote. The mayor denied any knowledge of Celestine or a man named Fremiet living in the house that she spoke. And this wasn't entirely true, because there was a man who had actually lived there, who was being described by Marie, but he was going by the name Raoul Dupont. So he didn't know anybody named George Fremiet that right. was living. It's like, yeah, this guy lives here, but I don't think it's your guy, necessarily. But he did put her in contact with a woman named Victorienne Pallant, who is the younger sister of Landru's sixth known victim, Anna Colum, who had made an identical inquiry about her own sister in 1917.
These sisters are doing it for themselves.
I know. I was about to say. So Marie contacted Victorine, and after talking about their separate investigations, they filed two missing persons complaints at the prosecutor's office.
Get it.
So these files found their way to Inspector Jules Villain, who interviewed both women, plagiarized most of Marie's report, and took full credit for Landru's arrest. What a cishet white man thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, let's talk about Mary Ellen Pleasant again.
Yeah. The reality of his arrest is that it was entirely by chance of him being cited on April 11th, 1919 by Marie's friend, Laurie Bonnoir, who was shopping. She saw him while he was out shopping with his mistress at the time. So Laurie was concerned that Landru would recognize her, though, and so she ran home to tell Marie, who then immediately phoned Inspector Balin, and then Balin returned to the store where Landru had been seen and retrieved the business card that Landru had given the shop assistant. He then went to the address indicated on the card, but Landru was going by another alias, Lucien Gulliard. Gillet?
What a name.
Yeah, the names are a lot. But Balin only had an arrest warrant for a man named Fremiet, so he decided to just call it a night.
Again, what a cishet white thing to do.
Yeah, but the next day, Balin returned with two fellow officers and a new warrant and arrested Landru, who had just returned from attacking a woman on the metro.
Oh.
Who survived. She didn't die.
Oh, good.
Just, like, accosted her. She just
accosted her. No biggie.
Landru refused to confirm his identity over multiple interrogations between 1919 and 1920 and protested his innocence, claiming these women were just his friends and he would not have hurt them because of that.
They were just really good.
Yeah. The magistrate that was investigating this case, Gabriel Bonin, probably... Probably Bonin, but we're going to call him Bonin.
Bonin wings, baby.
Oh, that sounds good. He was confident that he could wrap up the case in a matter of days after a discovery on April 29th, 1919, of some tiny fragments of charred human bones beneath a pile of leaves in Landru's garden. However, the situation might not be so cut and dry. In the weeks following his arrest, the police gathered tremendous evidence that LaDrew had stolen financial assets and possessions from the 10 missing women in a logbook that he had kept. He kept all the information, and the stash of goods he hadn't sold was at a garage and various storage depots, along with files on dozens of other women that he had contacted during the war, or that he was planning to contact. Police lacked something pretty important, though. Evidence of actual murders. So the bone...
It's a little important.
Yeah, it's a little important. The bone fragments were found were a puzzle. And the director of the police lab was able to state that they came from at least three different bodies, but there was no way for them to confirm that the skeletons were female or that they had come from the specific women that were known to have vanished. So they're like, yeah, we have bones, they're human, but like, I don't know. There's no way to connect them to anything.
But they could be any human.
Yeah. Well, and they, you know, it's not like they're carbon dating things in 1919, necessarily. Like, they're not able to say, like, these are from a year ago versus these are from 100 years ago.
Yeah, I guess, but do you think they would still be there? They were just under leaves, you said, right?
Yeah, but I mean, if he had tilled the garden or something, you know, things can get dug back up. I'm not saying that it's...
I don't know. I think it's fishy.
No, it definitely is. Like, I'm not saying that LaDrew did not kill these women, for clarification here. I'm saying that having that does not... It's not finding a dozen bodies underneath a house or something. Like, they didn't dig the garden up and find 10 bodies.
Yeah, it wasn't...
John Wayne Gacy. What was his name? Or something.
Oh, I was going to say, like, the guy in Chicago that we did.
Yeah.
Oh. Shit, I wish I could remember his name.
Yep.
I think it was Chicago. Or maybe it was Detroit.
No, I think it was like Detroit or...
Brewster Projects of Detroit, Michigan. He wouldn't say Alex, but I know it's...
No. Samuel Little.
I don't know, that still doesn't ring right to me, but sure.
Pretty sure. Maybe not. He's another prolific serial killer, though. Oh, I feel bad that I can't remember.
Hold on, I'm going to the episode guide. Because we both did an episode on him. It was after Dennis. After Mr. Dennis. I think it was after Dahmer, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Anthony Sowell.
Yeah, Anthony Sowell.
I knew it was an A. I fucking knew it was an A. What did I say?
Yeah, it's not like they didn't find a head in a book. You know, there wasn't like clear evidence that a murder happened here. Or enough blood to confirm. Like, there's no way someone survived this.
Right.
You know, they found... burned bone fragments under some leaves in a garden.
Which, okay, I guess isn't enough evidence.
Yeah.
But then where did all these fucking women connected to this one guy go?
Right. And, like, if this were to happen today, then it's possible that we could have taken those fragments of bone and actually connected them to a missing person. But right. Again, we're in 1919, so science is a little bit different.
A tiny bit early for that.
Yeah. So... The director managed to avoid speculating in his report, but it was definitely possible for the fragments to have come from other unknown victims as well.
Yeah.
And that possibility is reinforced later by some eyewitness evidence. And by later, I mean right now. I forgot this was immediately next.
Great.
An army doctor reported seeing LaDrew dumping a heavy package in a pond in late spring or early summer 1916. So this doctor was not able to testify at LaDrew's trial because he was really sick and he couldn't make it to the courthouse. But the prosecution acknowledged that the sighting didn't line up with the known disappearances, indicating the possibility of more victims, but not necessarily dwelling on it or trying to explore it. They were trying to get him for the ones that they thought he did commit, for sure. Like, the names on the list that they could connect to missing women. Which is still 10 victims, which is more than enough to get a hefty punishment, especially in 1919 in France.
This isn't Mr. Brock, whatever his name is, who has a bright future ahead of him.
Yeah. And this isn't, like, his first rodeo with this, either.
Mm-hmm.
Like, murder, yeah. But, you know, he's still wanted, remember? Like, he's still, he got sentenced in absentia to 4 years hard labor and then a life exile. Like,
No, no matter this dude's super fucked. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, no matter what happens, this guy's fucked. But let's try to get some, you know, justice for the families kind of thing. So as we talked about, Laundrie's family was complicit to varying degrees, but there were some unanswered questions. So, like, Charles helped his father from 1914 to 1919, clearing out five women's apartments. And after Laundrie's arrest, Charles also admitted his father helping his father with some unexplained gardening work, quote unquote, in early 1915, around the time that Jean and Andre Couchet disappeared.
Charles wasn't told that snitches get stitches, apparently.
Maurice had also been arrested in the military and was court-martialed, and he was he had pieces of jewelry that belonged to Couchet in his possession when he was arrested, this time in relation to these crimes.
Okay.
Marie Catherine, Laundrie's legal wife, had forged signatures so that he could gain access to his victim's bank accounts, and when interrogated, she said that she was innocent and her only crime had been, quote, to love my husband too much.
Oh, I fucking knew it.
End quote.
That writing was on the wall for that one.
The daughters seemed way less involved than the sons did. Marie said...
They're stupid little women who can't do anything.
Yeah, Marie said that she had no idea of his activities during the war. And Suzanne had actually moved out of the family home and when she got engaged and had only really like seen her father in passing on visits back home. So the worst they had was like, yeah, we knew where our dad was and we knew he was in trouble and we didn't tell the police, which is still not great. But there was no evidence indicating that they had any idea about the actual crime.
Right.
In December 1919, Bonin... the magistrate ordered the arrest of Mary Catherine and Maurice Laundrie on suspicion of complicity with the crime. They were never officially charged and were actually released in July of 1920. Basically, that they just didn't think that there was enough precedence or enough evidence to connect them enough to get them found guilty for anything. And that was also why they didn't bring up Charles into it either, because I think realistically, like, Charles has the most likely reason to think that maybe his dad didn't do it, because he was just there helping his dad clear out furniture, and his dad had worked in like furniture sales, so it would be easy. I could see in my head how he could say like, oh, we're just like repossessing this, or they moved and we're taking it back or whatever, and not realizing, because the murders, as far as we know, the murders are not believed to have happened like in their apartments. These happened at his house. So I don't necessarily think that especially Charles or the girls had any, I think there's enough room in there that I don't necessarily think they knew that it was murder. They knew that their dad was not a good guy, but there's a difference between being a good guy and being a cold-blooded murderer, being a good guy and being a cold-blooded. I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Like, a little bit. So Laundrie and his lawyer Vincent DeMauro Giaffri were eventually out of appeals against his previous convictions, and so the trial was held in Versailles.
Versailles.
I know that one. I knew that one and I said it wrong. Chosen because it was the largest town between where the victims were from and where the crimes were alleged to have happened. So basically they took the crimes, they took the trial out of either place where they would have been most affected and put it kind of in the middle. Photographers were allowed in the court by the presiding judge, Maurice Gilbert, which just stoked the sensational atmosphere around the long-awaited trial of, quote, the blue beard of Jambé. So, you know, this is getting a lot of press coverage, and the coverage of the trial was just saturating the newspapers, and it attracted literal trainloads of spectators to the trial. Even celebrities, including... what was it described as the queen of French musical theater, Miss Nguyen?
I'm sure that's correct.
I'm sure, yeah. Actors Maurice Chevalier and Sasha Guthrie. Author Rudyard Kipling, who was like just in town to get a honorary like diploma from a college. But he was like, yeah, I'll go. And novelist Colette, to name a few. By the end of the trial, Judge Gilbert had lost all control of the audience. With as many as 500 spectators inside the courtroom that was designed to only hold 250 people.
Checks out. They really needed to live stream it.
Yeah. So Landru's defense attorney, Moreau, was pretty famous in France at the time and secretly fucking hated Landru and thought he was actually insane.
Hmm. I mean...
yeah.
We don't know he's wrong.
So Moreau, though, was a passionate opponent of the death penalty, and he did not believe that the prosecution could prove that Landru had killed 10 women and one young man with certain. Moreau instead suggested a bargain to the jury that the defense would not contest the charges of theft and fraud, which would be enough to send Landru into exile with hard labor, an ordeal that would likely kill Landru before long, given his poor health. Yeah. But Moreau had one chief problem, keeping Landru shut the hell up and under control during the trial. At one point, Landru made it clear, repeatedly, that he knew more about the fate of the women than he was willing to reveal, because he had, quote, a sacred compact with them, which swore him into silence.
Well, what a way to go. that's quite the yeah. That's quite the defense. Yeah. That's like when Laurie said, I know my children are in heaven and Jesus is keeping them busy. And I'm like, my God, Laurie. I know what happened to my children. Yeah, tell us.
Yeah, please. So he continued, Landru continued to add the impression of his guilt by arguing that he had only pursued women via Lonely Hearts ads as a means to steal their furniture. So that makes it okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. He denied that any of them had been mistresses, insisting that the list of names in his notebook were simply the names of his clients that happened to just line up with a bunch of women that went missing and it's not related at all.
Yeah, not related.
No. Moreau realized that his best chance at avoiding the death penalty was to point out the overall weakness of the murder case. He pointed out that the 157 witnesses on the prosecution's list, none of them had any direct evidence of a murder occurring. So of 157 people, none of them could prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
None of them had even seen a murder happen. None of them had heard him talk about murdering people. Nothing.
That's some pretty good evidence. Yeah. That you were like, you know, that's a pretty good defense.
All the mothers, sisters, and female friends of the missing women, all they could do was produce proof of Landru's trickery, which the defense was not disputing. He was like, yeah, he's a shitty dude, but he didn't kill him. You can't prove he killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So Moreau also pointed out that Landru's house had not been sealed after the first search, and so the bones could have been planted there to incriminate Landru, as there was reasonable doubt there, because they hadn't sealed it, and they found the bones on the second search, not the first search.
Mm.
So it had been like 10 days in between the two.
So... yeah, somebody could have planted that evidence.
Yeah,
yeah.
The chief prosecuting attorney Robert Godefroy struggled from the start of the trial to make any headway with Landru or prevent Moreau from absolutely destroying the credibility of the police and the witnesses.
Well, that's not hard.
Yeah. His inability resulted in Judge Gilbert basically taking over the examination of Landru, which is a thing that could happen in the French judicial system. It doesn't discourage at least the time, I don't know if it's different now, but it didn't discourage the judge from intervening and interviewing like the U.S. Trials do, where the judge is kind of there to be a moderator more than anything.
Right.
Until the end of the trial. While Gilbert did get some good points in, especially about the records in the notebook, the consensus of the reporters was that the trial's outcome would depend on the closing speeches. For his closing remarks, Godefroy had to... he actually had to split it over 2 days because he had the flu. And he became too ill to complete his closing statements the first day.
That sucks.
Yeah, and so he itemized 8, quote, proofs, which demonstrated Landru's guilt beyond all doubt, at least in his mind. This included the one-way train tickets that Landru had bought the women, to the telltale noting of the hour that they disappeared in the notebook. So that was, like, included with their name and information. It was just, like, an hour. And it was speculated that that was the hour that he killed them.
Yeah.
Moro then stood and tore the absolute shit out of supposed certainty in this case. But he couldn't explain why none of the women had surfaced following Landru's arrest, instead suggesting that Landru had sex trafficked the women abroad. Like, that's not also terrible.
But that's not what he's on trial for.
Yeah, but he suggested that this made some sense because all the women had been estranged from their families, an allegation that was extremely untrue in several cases and only a little untrue in others. The majority of these women did have people in their lives that were looking for them and were missing, whether or not, like, they were close.
Sisters that were doing it for themselves.
Yeah. He also tried to demonstrate that there was no certainty the women were actually dead, stating to the court that the victims had been found and were going to come and appear in the court.
What?
He motioned in a direction, and the public and jurors turned their heads to where he motioned.
And then they ran away.
He let the suspense...
Hey, is that Elvis?
He let the suspense hang for a moment before saying that the fact that all of those that turned their heads demonstrated their lack of certainty that these women were dead.
Damn. Okay, that's good.
I know, right? I read that and I was like, shit.
Got him.
But the attorney general retorted straight away that Landru had not turned his head.
Oh. He's also crazy.
Yeah. He also knows they're dead.
That's, yeah. That's not true.
Okay, so on... Let's see. On November 30th, 1921, the jury delivered their verdict after 3 hours of deliberation. It was...
longer than I expected, honestly.
Yeah, it was 9-3 that they found Landru guilty of all 11 murders. And they also unanimously convicted Landru of all the counts of theft and fraud. That wasn't even a question. Oh, yeah. In the mayhem of the verdict, Moro tried to get the jurors to sign an appeal for clemency to avoid the death penalty. However... Landru refused to sign it because, of course, he was totally innocent. Why would he sign this? So, Landru was eventually persuaded to sign the appeal, but then that was later rejected by the French president at the time.
Mm.
Landru was executed on February 25th, 1922. The whole procedure from walking him out to his beheading took approximately 20 seconds.
Whoa! Yeah. They weren't wasting any fucking time, were they?
So in the 1930s, Landru's house was converted into a restaurant using the notoriety of the case to drum up business.
Gross.
The house still stands, and in 2017 it was actually put up for sale, so you could probably look it up on Zillow, I don't know. Landru's notorious oven, in which he allegedly burned the remains of his victims, sold at an auction in 1923 to an Italian businessman who wanted to put it on display in Turin. Turin said nar, and the oven then disappeared from public view.
Good.
In 1968, a sketch of the oven that Landru had drawn during the trial was discovered, and next to it was a note saying, quote, "One can burn anything one wants in there," end quote.
Ooh.
This was evidently a remark that had been said to him by a woman who had visited his house, like a survivor of going to his house. And also for clarification, the picture was entrusted to his attorney's daughter, Moro's daughter. And then that's how it kind of came through. And so there is provenance there that... this had a direct connection to Landru. This is not a forgery.
Right.
Of. The back of the note had another message from Landru saying, quote, "This demonstrates the stupidity of the witness. Nothing happened in front of the wall, but in the house," end quote. And this statement's unclear. No one that I found has, like, made it make sense 100%, but it makes me think that there was a witness who was suggesting seeing something happening outside of the walls of the home when all the murders actually happened inside
in the home. Yeah.
But yeah, so that's the Bluebeard of Gambe. he sucked a bunch.
That's, yeah, that guy super sucked. Now he's dead.
Super dead. He's been dead for a long time. And also, like, so he got buried in the cemetery, and then his family, 5 years after he got buried, refused to continue paying the lease for his grave, and so he was disinterred and then buried just, like, in an unmarked grave, like a pauper's grave. And
yeah, that happens.
Like, man, that's, you have a fucking lease? That's,
that, no, that's, like, I think that's still the case in, like, Europe. You, because it's so populated and it has been like burying people for so long, you pay for a certain amount of time, and then when you stop paying, you get removed from that spot, and that spot gets used again by somebody else.
That's wild.
And you get put like in a mausoleum or some shit.
Just start in the mausoleum.
A lot of the times you're already yeah, like I can't remember which episode I talked about it in, but I could probably find out. But yeah, I do remember.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that I don't believe it. I just forgot, I guess. I'm sorry.
There's a lot of episodes that have the word grave in them. So, yeah. And a few that have rent in them, but probably not. It might have been the vampire one. I don't know. I'd have to really go back and look, because I don't know how I would have, what wording I would have used for that. But yeah, it was one of the ones in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah. But yeah. Hey, real quick. This has nothing to do with the episode. Have you heard that there's like a conspiracy, or like there's information coming out now about Gypsy Rose Blanchard?
Yeah,
I saw the TikTok you sent me. More involvement?
Yeah. I'm curious to see how that goes.
I hope that I can't remember the guy's name. Nick?
Oh, yeah, I think Nick something. I think that's right.
I hope they get him sorted out. Because that's super fucked if she's already out and he's just getting life.
Yeah.
After he was manipulated like that. I think that there's cause for, especially with his issues going on and everything. But anyway, we should talk about that sometime.
Yeah. Once that's everything shakes out, I think we should probably cover it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us today as we explored the story of Henri Landru, the Bluebeard of Gambe. And now we want to hear from you. So send us your stories, your questions, and your feedback to strangeunusualpodcast@gmail.com. If you are sending a story, we just ask that you put listener story in the subject line so that we can sort through those a little more easily. Do you know any Bluebeard? You should go to the police and let them know.
Yeah, and then you should come and tell us.
But then also tell us about it, yeah.
You can also find us on Instagram and Threads at strange_unusual_podcast, or our personal accounts Royal Rampage and Calamity Casey. You can find us on X at _strangeunusual, at Calamity Casey, and at Royal Rampage. We're also on Facebook. Just search for the Strange and Unusual Podcast and look for our logo. I'm also streaming on Twitch at twitch.tv/RoyRampage. And if you'd like, you can join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/strangeunusual, where we've got old bonus episodes, we've got access to our Discord, we have a poll, a monthly poll that happens that our Patreons get to vote on. This time it was for me, and it's actually going to be She Wants Revenge is the poll winner. So it will be some woman who gets some sort of righteous revenge, whether it's, you know, everyone is happy that she got revenge or not at the end. We'll find out. But
because, like the chicks, we love Marianne and we love Wanda, but not every story is Marianne and Wanda.
Yeah. And you have access to our Discord as well. But we understand right now that things are still expensive and you might not be able to support us financially. And if you're unable to do so, we totally get it. We just ask that you like, share, subscribe, rate, review, share us with your friends, share us with your enemies, share us with your blue beards. Maybe not, but
don't.
Maybe? I don't know. I mean, it's still interaction, right?
Yeah, it's still... Get that algorithm and all that.
But we'd really like to hear from you, and we really like interacting with you guys. So, if you want to reach out, that would be cool beans.
Cool beans. Wow. I was talking to my friend Kathleen last night, and we were talking about, like, shit we say, or, like, shit that we said in high school and stuff.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
Like, every once in a while, you still say it, you're like, whoa, what year is it? She was saying she was stoked. We were playing Raft, and I said, this shark won't take me out. He won't do it. No balls. Fight me, shark.
But anyway,
Blue Burger, the fucking shark.
I should let you go because you got things to do.
I do.
Oh, bye. Fun. Bye.